Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to us on iTunes. Today is Friday, February 20th, 2015. It's approximately 12:27 p.m. here in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 26th episode of the show. In this episode, I'll be talking with astrologer Mark Jones about contrasting modern and traditional views on difficult chart placements. Mark's background is in astrological counseling and psychology, and he specializes in evolutionary astrology in particular. His 2011 book was titled Healing the Soul, Pluto, Uranus, and the Lunar Nodes, and his second book is titled The Soul Speaks, The Therapeutic Potential of Astrology, and that book will be released in May of this year, of 2015. You can find out more information about his work at PlutoSchool.com. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So our topic today is contrasting the modern and traditional views on difficult chart placements. And I've been wanting to have a discussion with you about this for about, I think, 2 years now, or a recorded discussion, because we've actually had a few discussions since the Northwest Astrological Conference in 2013, where I think that was probably our first actual serious conversation. And this interesting question, you actually had an interesting question for me that you raised, which led to not just an interesting discussion at the time, but also an interesting series of discussions that we've had since then, as well as a friendship and so on and so forth. So let's start off with what your question is. I'm not sure if I'm remembering it perfectly as it was phrased at the time, but what it was, I guess, to set the stage is there's a bunch of us astrologers sitting around in the lobby in the middle of this conference, and we're all in a circle around sort of like a coffee table in the middle. And I'm sitting directly across from you, and from what I recall, I think you leaned across the table, and maybe I'm like, my brain is making this up, but like sort of halfway pointed at me and directed this very sort of pointed question at me, which was something to the effect of, aren't you doing harm to your clients by using distinctions like benefic and malefic in order to cast things in an entirely black and white manner? Do you think, was that more or less what you said?
I mean, I think that's the theoretical abstraction of what I said. I think I actually opened by saying something like, I just spent my day, you know, teaching and, you know, exploring the undermining of the idea that there are benefic and malefic aspects in that sense. What, you know, what do you make of that? And I think you've positioned this fairly politely, really. I mean, I was being playful, yes, but there was a modicum of aggression in it, I guess. Yes, leaning forward for sure. And, you know, seeing what your response would be. And I guess, you know, to share with your audience, your response was so thoughtful and considered. And I felt it had intellectual acuity and integrity on a personal and, you know, professional level. Like, you properly thought about the question, and it wasn't just something that blindsided you, which is the reason why you and I have had so many interesting conversations about this material since, because, you know, you responded to a guy, you know, at least 20% being a jackass and, you know, 80% for real, and you amplified the reality of the situation in a very interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, that exchange, I think both of us, even though it started off with you being, certainly is a very aggressive question, and like, it's kind of like a gotcha question, where I think there's some circumstances where maybe, I don't know what you were expecting me to say. I don't think you thought I would have a response. And so I was supposed to like burst into tears and like run out of the room.
Whereas actually you used it as this incredibly elegant thing to come back towards at the end, to the power of equal houses, that I must have a first, you know, that's a brilliant example of my first house Mars. Yeah. I'd even done that rather than, from my point of view with the quadrant house system, having Mars in the 12th house, but conjunct the ascendant in Sagittarius, and obviously evidencing my own strong opinionation at the time. It was very elegantly done, I have to say. And you certainly did not cry and run out of the room. And I think that's, I had no idea what I was doing, to be honest. I think I was letting off steam after a long workshop, and in which I felt that certain powerful themes about transformation and healing had been raised for me. I think this is, it's been part of a series of one-day workshops I've done at NORWAC prior to the conference starting, in which I explore themes such as the astrology of healing, or one was on the true and essential self, I think, that year that we had that conversation. That's what I taught on. And in this next NORWAC, it's going to be the astrology of self-actualization. And I've been really exploring these intense themes that have emerged from me since being a therapist and really working with clients long-term about issues like childhood shame or, you know, the aftermath of abuse, you know, sexual, psychological, emotional abuse, and what it means, what good and bad in that kind of way that might, you know, have this resonance intellectually as a subject matter in astrology, might have as an impact emotionally and psychologically to a person who's had enormous pressures on their development in these kinds of ways. And what's going on with good or bad in that kind of sense? How extraordinarily loaded terms like malefic or benefic or good or bad or fall or detriment or exaltation can become in the emotional and psychological realm for an individual. Do you see what I mean?
Right, because you're not dealing with this as some sort of like theoretical abstraction. Like you're actually working in the trenches with clients day in, day out that have serious you know, psychological and emotional and other like practical issues that they're wrestling with and struggling with on a daily basis. So this is a very real sort of pressing question to you when you posed it. It wasn't just something, I mean, you were certainly saying it in a pointed way, but also you had something behind it in terms of seeing as many clients as you have had in a therapeutic context and thinking about the implications of how astrology is phrased and how they might interpret that and what that might do to them psychologically.
Exactly, Chris. I mean, that's just it. Exactly. It's coming up now in the last 12 or 13 years, maybe 9, maybe somewhere between 8, 9, 10,000 clinical hours of working with people. And when shame or guilt or childhood shame or guilt or post-traumatic stress occupies the session, it can really take hold of absolutely anything, and very much including the chart or astrology. And by that I mean that clients can be in such strong reactions to past events or ways that they were treated or ways that they lacked validation from those around them or experienced intense abuse to the level that they see their own chart as a source of shame. That literally the whole chart, the whole circle, every placement is just somehow I've got a bad chart.
Interesting.
And the fear is when they work with me, you know, you will see that I have a bad chart. Or here is my chart, I've been told before, but please don't tell me anything direct about it because I know you can just see how, you know, how tough I've got it, how wrong it is, you know.
Sure.
And it becomes like this way that the transference and the strong feelings from the past plays out. And there's this projection I found with astrology, you know, and it's not entirely untrue. You know, you're a bright young man, intellectually gifted, hardworking, studious. You've learned techniques and studied things that might genuinely help people. Of that, I have no doubt. And then that gets magically invested by the client who has been through terrible things in their life, you know, who journeys far to an astrology conference or seeks you out online or to go to your hometown and have a reading. And they will invest the significance at times in that reading that may include their very sense of well-being, may include like how they fundamentally feel about themselves. And if that's treated carefully by the astrologer and validated and supported, that person might leave that reading buoyed up, you know, with this sense of possibility and potential for the future. And if it's not handled right, and, you know, I see a clear potential problem with terms like malefic or detriment or fall, or, you know, you've got this incredibly tough Venus or something, you know, to a woman, and but this is how he might help you get out of it. To a woman with intense shame because of, say, physical, emotional, sexual abuse from her parents or her father growing up, this could be a tremendous source of anxiety that could stay with her long after the reading, long after what was essentially a technical point by an astrologer weighing up the pros and cons of her chart. Do you see what I mean?
Sure. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And I guess, so sort of drawing it back, I mean, what my response to you was at the time was something to the effect that, not acknowledging these distinctions, even though modern astrologers like the attempt, and what you're saying is that you want a consultation to be empowering, you want it to be positive, you want it to be something that's like a reinforcing and sort of optimistic perspective in some sense on the person's life. And part of my response was that by not acknowledging these distinctions like benefic and malefic, we can sometimes do a disservice to clients by not validating the subjective experience of their life. Because I feel like oftentimes where the rejection of the benefic-malefic distinction is coming from is in the observation or in the philosophical position that everything works out for a reason or everything works out for the best or that everything that we go through is part of a growth sort of process or that we're all evolving in some way, either mentally or psychologically or spiritually. And therefore, from that sort of universal perspective or that objective perspective, there's no such thing as good and bad. There's just events that happen along the way in our growth process. But one of my objections to that, because this has been something, and the only reason that I had a good answer for you at the time, and then I was also, I was also impressed by your response to my answer, because you didn't just blow me off or you didn't just get, annoyed and sort of double down on your position or something like that. But you actually realized I was giving you a reasonably well thought out response to the question that you didn't anticipate. And the way that you dealt with that actually I thought was impressive, which is why we've talked so much in the past couple of years. What I was saying, though, is that while I can acknowledge that standpoint of looking at things from an objective or universal standpoint and from a growth-oriented standpoint, at some point in that process, I feel like we stop looking at and almost devalue the subjective experience of the life. And in terms of a person's subjective experience, we do make distinctions such as, I don't want to say good or bad, but preferable, let's say, or unpreferable.
Exactly.
Everybody would prefer to, let's say, someday get married and have a happy and fulfilling relationship versus everybody would generally not prefer to, get married and have their spouse die or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with those distinctions.
Yeah, and clearly, you see, traumatized people, by definition, trauma knocks people out of themselves. Trauma is the living proof that, from a personal standpoint, people do not just get what they can handle. That kind of New Age mantra or saying you only get what, God feels you can take or what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Trauma is the living proof that on a personal level that's not the case. People are clearly bowled over by things. People are clearly overwhelmed by things. They are shaped by childhood events or reinforced significant trauma, say like sexual abuse from a trusted parental figure or an attack from a pedophile on the street. These things shape people's sense of basic safety and overwhelm a child. The child has no apparatus to deal with how to integrate that. So I think this is a very valid point on that level. In the personal experience terms, if there is a truth to this idea that everything, there's a universal or divine justice, and I certainly feel that there is, it is a very complex level of truth. It's a level of truth related to the ultimate level of experience. And in the kind of day-to-day, in the relative world, I think we could make that distinction like the Buddhists do between ultimate truth and relative truth. Within the world of relative truth, people are bowled over by life experiences. Even they feel devastated. They feel destroyed by them. And I work with people who feel destroyed by their lives. And sometimes, like a phoenix from the ashes, they rise up over many years of work and reclaim that. And sometimes that's too much for them. And I've seen both. And I've seen clients on the edge of harming themselves. And I've known therapists who have killed themselves. So, in this world, there's no way the so-called healers are immune from these overwhelming forces. So, I guess you've got to be very careful. You've got to really examine yourself on an astrological point of view, haven't you? And technically, if you really feel that you have created techniques that can fairly accurately predict, say, whether this marriage is auspicious or not, in real terms, and that can be presented in some kind of way, because I guess it'd be quite hard for me to imagine that in a sort of 90 or 100% kind of way. And I've never really looked at difficult aspects in that kind of a way, I guess. But then I am very much a therapist or a therapeutically orientated astrologer. I'm always looking at not what can give an optimistic vision necessarily, although I think in a reading, in a one-off meeting, not finding some kind of optimism together may be a bit of a failure of the situation. But I am very much into a transformational offering. You know, now I would see a difference between that and an optimistic offering, because some people are in very difficult life circumstances, and it does not serve them to pretend that that's not the case.
What do you define as transformational? Something that takes the difficulties that they're going through and gives it a constructive spin, or how you...
Well, I mean, let me give an example. I mean, this isn't a total answer, but it's an example of how much I might work in a certain way. I mean, I pretty much suspended a reading once. I mean, I just, for all intents and purposes, I didn't really continue to read the chart, because it emerged, talking about the difficult relationship signatures in the chart, that the individual having the reading was being actively beaten by their current boyfriend on a regular basis. He would come round to the house to date them, to have date night, and after a couple of beers would start hitting them around the house. And I turned, in quotes, the reading. I mean, I acted like a therapist, I guess. I tried to lay a boundary around the trauma. And I remember speaking to this lady again many years later, and she'd come to see me give a talk at a conference, and she'd realized how much more I had to offer astrologically in a way than I'd offered her. And she was quite upset about it. And I put my hand on her shoulder. I looked her in the eye. I said, well, you know, that day I made a very profound point. I said, you know, you're going to draw a line around your house. This person's never going to come into it again. You're going to bless your house in this way. You're going to create it as a safe space for your recovery from these emotional dynamics we've spoken about. You know, I took the gamble that that was worth doing. And what happened? And she said, I did do that. He never came around. He never beat me again after that reading. And I said, well, that's why I sacrificed, you know, further astrological information that you might have wanted at that time, because that felt like an abstract to me compared to the reality of the situation you're in. And she acknowledged that and was quite moved and was crying, and she was still somewhat frustrated that she hadn't had the other side of me. But I mean, I made that judgment call, and I'd make it again.
Sure. And I mean, that brings up a really important point, which is that and it's important in these discussions, because like your primary, the primary way that you're framing and contextualizing questions like this is within the context of, you know, what would a client think, or how would that affect a client? Whereas that's not always necessarily the way that I'm framing or contextualizing this question of, is benefic and malefic a valid distinction at all from a technical standpoint, even amongst discussions between astrologers? And that's an important point, because those are almost like two separate discussions. One, you know, should we use terms like that that do sound more black and white or more good and bad or what have you within the context of a consultation setting, versus this other discussion that has to take place, which is that a valid distinction, period? Because some astrologers, you know, such as I think Eric Myers, who I had the debate with last year, argue that they're not, that there is no sort of validity to that distinction, even from a purely technical standpoint, regardless of if we're talking about clients or talking amongst astrologers or what have you.
Okay, so this raises a number of interesting points. One, in recent times, this has only come very recently, the idea has occurred to me that we might want to start almost different names, like client-orientated astrologers, or there might be a term for astrologers who focus primarily on readings and how astrology as a living transformational tool will maybe change people's lives, as opposed to like research astrologers, people who want to, you know, research the cultural origins of astrology or write history books about it, you know, essentially examine it as an archaeology, as an artifact, rather than a living transformational tool. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I would argue that's a completely different pursuit. And it may be very hard to distinguish, because certain very bright people in that realm may rise up to be very high placed in certain institutions, and then people project, outsiders project, that means that they are very, very focused on using the chart as a living transformational tool, and they're the person to go and see to get this help. And actually, that might not be the case. And then the other question is, you know, what do I think about benefic and malefic, I guess, underlyingly, you know, from a technical level, because I am a technical astrologer too, and I think that's what makes my perspective quite unusual in a way, in that, yes, I'm an out-and-out therapist, and I have a private practice in therapy, and, you know, I don't always have people's charts within that. I mean, I increasingly do, but I'm also an out-and-out astrologer. I've done hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of readings, you know, just one-off readings as an astrologer, not, you know, as an astrologer who's also a therapist, fine, but reading a chart. I do have a method. I teach schools. And now in my method, I would very much say there's an acknowledgement of difficult placements. So I've, for example, developed ideas like trauma signatures from the perception of Uranus as a kind of aspect of transpersonal mind. But I do not have the traditional ruling of benefic and malefic, you know, like, or like, you know, Venus in Pisces is exalted mm-hmm. or something. I don't experience that in an obvious way. And that could be, I'm completely open to this, a paradigm blindness on my part, not following a traditional astrological method. But, you know, for example, a friend of mine with Venus in Pisces was very, very lost soul when I was growing up, and he was the only he was half, you know, he had multiple ethnic backgrounds. He grew up in a middle class village in the middle of, you know, Thatcher and Reagan era with me, and, you know, everyone was white and, you know, Protestant in this village apart from him, and he was my best friend. And certain psychic pressures really collapsed on him, and there was a classic case of, you know, schizophrenia is often linked to people who have made a huge cultural transition. The next generation that are born to the people who traveled from another country to a place, often prone to mental illness. He collapsed to schizophrenia, but there was always this kind of insecurity he had about the way he related to himself as he was trying on all these different costumes. And he had this glorious mane of hair and this beautiful aura around him. He was a really attractive person. He was a sweetheart, really. But the Venus in Pisces quality in him was just destroyed by what he went through. It was a very vulnerable quality. So it's never been something – I've never related to the quality of, say, an exaltation as if it just meant that something inexorably shone out of that person's life in a successful way. But maybe I'm misunderstanding what those things mean.
Yeah. I mean, one of the issues that I ran into with Eric is the tendency, I think, for sometimes modern astrologers to hear about certain placements like that, like exaltation or fall or something like that, and then to take them into account in isolation, where with your friend, for example, while, you know, he may have had Venus exalted in Pisces, and on the surface that might have been theoretically a more favorable placement for certain things related to Venus in his life, that's not to say that Venus couldn't have had some other, let's say, quote-unquote, affliction in some way, which could have completely yes. reversed any supposed gains that would be indicated by the otherwise favorable placement of exaltation. And so sometimes when we get into discussions like this, when we're talking about one-off example charts, I run into – actually, no, I use that as an argument point with Eric, actually, because I knew some of the examples that he wanted to talk about. And then I brought them with me and showed how in almost every one of the examples where he wanted to point out how – you know, a planet being in its own sign or being its exaltation or what have you was not, in fact, a favorable placement in this person's life. I was able to demonstrate in almost every example he picked up that there were other major counteracting factors that he wasn't taking into account. And in that way, it's kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say a bad argument, but you have to be careful about making arguments like that because in the same way that I think, you know, a skeptic might say, you know, well, all astrologers that do sun sign astrology think that the world is neatly divided into 12 segments, and that's obviously not the case. An astrologer would say, well, in fact, if you look at a birth chart, there's hundreds of factors that we take into account. It's not just about this one thing, and therefore it's kind of like a false argument to frame yes. it purely in that way.
So we come to a kind of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and in the overall paradigm of traditional astrology, if I've got this right, that a whole complex series of factors we would want to bring to bear on the question of how a chart might play out, then it would be very important, obviously, then, for this high degree of integrity and skill in operating like that. You know, that's not the way. I mean, I've chosen to specialize really in looking at charts for what you might call soul or like personal essence. How does a person's highest truth of their true potential manifest in this life? And that's how I look at charts, as a window to that potential. Now, I certainly see challenges within that. I see potential for like childhood developmental blocks, karmic trauma brought into childhood trauma, you know, and I'm relatively speaking, a specialist in analyzing charts to see those kinds of traumas. So in my work, with this very specific focus on like trauma signatures, complex patterns of karmic memory that tend to then play into early childhood experience, which then tend to become the emotional and psychological foundations of an individual's life, which may then unconsciously dominate their relationships or their working life or their creative life in a way that they got no idea how to do anything about. It feels like it's beyond them, and it can be very, very painful. And then the usefulness of that is to try and find, you know, the unconscious roots or these more complex factors underneath. So I very much sympathize with this idea of being very delicate at how we would explore, you know, in a sense, the chart as a crime scene. You know, you would want to be a crime scene investigator. You wouldn't want to just come in and see the blood on the wall and see there's a knife over there, you know, and just necessarily equate the two. The knife might have been used to chop vegetables, and the blood's from something completely different. I'm very aware that it's not a simplistic process. And I think that's why I'm very interested to see, really on a personal level, Chris, you know, the work you do and others of, you know, similar caliber as your good self. Can these traditional Hellenistic techniques be brought forward in a way that has sufficient examination and experiential evidence from working with people and giving readings and analyzing historical and other figures to offer something that will help in that delicate balancing act, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I mean, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is maybe distinguishing between those that focus on the theoretical sort of side of astrology versus the practical side in seeing clients. And I think on some level, that's a valid distinction, because I think it is important to distinguish between those two things, because they're kind of different processes, one of which is seeing clients and one of which is figuring out what the theoretical principles are of astrology and developing the techniques in a way that's theoretically consistent. And that draws out not just the theory, but also the philosophy and, you know, helps with the practice. But, one thing I will say is that I don't think that, I mean, most astrologers that still engage in discussions about like the philosophy or like the theoretical foundations of astrology, they often do still see clients. So it's not that there's this complete distinction where there's just like, we have the practicing astrologers and then we have the guys that go off and just think about or theorize things. But often there's a lot of overlap between those two, because all astrologers rely on, if they're full-time astrologers, they rely on seeing clients typically as their primary income. So you do see them sort of implying some of their techniques in the field. And additionally, it's not, and for that reason, it's not just a matter of sort of archaeology when you see somebody going back and researching some of the older techniques or what have you, but I would more liken it to the way that we have sort of like theoretical physicists who sometimes, you know, work out problems or work out things conceptually, or sometimes are focused on creating a sort of intact or integrated conceptual models. But then those conceptual models are often put to the test. And if they hold up, then it becomes sort of a standard. And if they don't, then they're rejected. And that's probably a closer analogy, I think, to what some astrologers that are doing that are focused on some of these conceptual issues at the same time as, you know, applying techniques to clients.
Exactly. And you see, the ideal would become that one's theoretical visioning, and I myself are engaged in a project in that. I mean, after the book on the therapeutic potential of astrology, The Soul Speaks, that comes out in May, I will be going back to working on the book on the planetary nodes, which is one of my great sort of research contributions to astrology, if you like, or fingers crossed it is anyway. And the ideal would be that that kind of research would feed the client work, and then that the client work would feed that kind of research, because you'd have direct feedback from living people. What I find is there becomes this fantasy, there's two things that go on. One's a practical problem. Like you said, people need to make a living and see clients. And that happens to therapists too. You get therapists, you know, often older therapists who've done it for years, and they don't want to do it anymore, but they just don't have any other way to make a living. And that becomes its own problem. Mm-hmm. And I've always said to myself, hand on heart, if I didn't want to work with people anymore, that I would have the courage to try and do something else instead. But the theoretical issue, I think, is there's this paradigm sometimes with astrology, because it's this magical thing, because it's this like at its highest potential, almost window to the soul, that, you know, people are going to come along and the astrologer is just going to perform this reality to them. They're just going to come along like to a magic show and say, magical Chris Brennan, this very bright, studious young man who's read all these ancient books that I haven't read, is going to perform this reality for me. And of course, I've been experimenting as a therapist with this completely other reality where, to me, the client is the central resource of the reading. Or it's a combination of the client, their chart, and me. But mainly the client and their chart. And that they dance together. So instead of trying to predict certain things or make assessments based on a technical appraisal of, let's say, their Venus and their relationship to themselves or their intimate relationships in their life, I'll just ask them. I'll just go, how do you feel about yourself? And how are your relationships in your life? And as they talk to me, I'll also have their chart memorized usually in my mind. And I will let that then sort of speak to me about what they're saying. But I'll ground it in what they're saying so that it always has this living relationship to where they're coming from. The danger of the research astrologer that's, you know, say very into the Saturn-Uranus midpoint, as the total expression of everything, you know, right, is that every client that comes through the door has a Saturn-Uranus midpoint reading, whether that was the real critical issue for that client or not. That's the danger for me, that the research fantasy, you know, my hobby horse, as Lawrence Stern, the author of Tristram Shandy, would put it, you know, my intellectual thing that fires me up is then just what every client gets, whether that was the crucial thing going on for them or not, which is why I always start by going, how can I help today? And that's to elicit, you know, what's going on for you in your world, so I can link this strange circle with all these symbols on it to your life, not the other way around, not try and stretch your life to fit my theories of astrology.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting territory for me.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's interesting in and of itself and probably worth discussing, like the typical, it's a pretty standard sort of inversion of what I think a client would expect when they normally come in to see like an astrologer or come in to see like a tarot reader or someone else that is, I mean, I guess it depends on your definition of what astrology is, but let's say if we're classifying it as a type of divination or a type of fortune telling or what have you, like most people come in off the streets expecting you to tell them things about their life. And for a large part of the later part of the 20th century, that was sort of the new approach that was taken, the inversion, where because of the integration with sort of therapy or with counseling, astrologers stopped trying to just make blanket statements based on the chart or make predictions just based on chart placements right from the start to sort of impress the client almost, because it's really more of a parlor trick on some level. It's not a parlor trick. It's actually if you can do it and you make statements about a person's life that are actually valid and relevant based on where the planets were at the moment of their birth, that's actually very interesting and impressive. But
it's a magician though. It's a magician's act, isn't it?
It is, depending on what your point is. Like if the point of the a consultation session is to get to like deep psychological issues and work through things like what you're doing, then yeah, that is like a distraction and a waste of time, because then it's more like you establishing some sort of authority or that you can do this rather than doing something that's practically valuable in terms of working through the client's issues, which obviously you can get to much quicker if you just ask them, what is your issue? And then you start looking at the chart and being able to contextualize their issues within the context of their chart, versus trying to look at the chart and immediately guess out of all of the 100 things that are going on what their primary focus is at that time.
Exactly. You're exactly right. You know, as this person who's was trained to work with people over longer periods of time, who sat there with an individual maybe for 1 hour in a hotel somewhere at a conference to summarize all those years of working with hundreds of people and helping them into this 1 hour, and to waste my time maybe trying to second guess some astrological signatures to see if I can, like you say, almost just like impress them or something. What happens if you just drop that entire game? What happens if you just surrender that? What happens if you can just breathe in the inner confidence that you are there as an empowered human being to serve the higher good of everyone, but especially this person who's come before you, who's asking you as a supplicant, you know, to help them with some degree of guidance. So I would look at it as guidance rather than divination, which totally keys into Roberto Saggioli, the Italian doctor who created psychosynthesis, really arguably the first really spiritual depth psychology. He called his name for the therapist was a guide, the guide to the person, the guide to their true potential, and you're there to serve it. And then everything becomes practical then, everything like you say. It's much more rapid to go, what's your real issue? And then you see that the reality is the whole hour can be spent on that real issue rather than this fantasy that I have to do the routine, you know, the dog and pony show, the magic show. I have to do the sawing in half and the disappearing act. Otherwise, I can't call myself an astrologer anymore.
Yeah, and there's
what's obviously more important? Yeah.
Well, and there's obviously something appealing about that, because then you can zero in on, you know, they describe their issue, and then it's clear that what they're describing fits symbolically in terms of some Saturn transit that they're having, and therefore you can then discuss that and discuss the duration of it or the extent of it and when it began and when it ends and what other things might be connected to it versus you know, narrowing in on some other transits or progressions or what have you that may be occurring in their life and might be coinciding with other sort of issues that are going on in different areas of their life, but might not be their primary focus at the time. I guess the counter argument, though, or the part that makes me think that there might still be something valid to, you know, being able to just look at at a chart from a highly technical standpoint and zero in precisely on what the person's primary issues were without hearing from them yet, or without really talking to them, is the sort of accusation that's often leveled against astrologers by skeptics and such of cold reading. And so the fear of, or the question of, could you, if you needed to sit down and pull up what the person's main issues are, or accurately describe this person's personality or the rough outlines of their life without hearing anything about them or knowing very little about them, could you do it? And that's an important and sort of valid and still interesting question to me as sort of a side thing in terms of practicing astrology in the 21st century and being able to demonstrate its validity and this sort of precarious position that astrologers are in, where we aren't usually recognized as having any validity, and therefore things like that or the ability to do things like that does have some sort of objective value, even if it's not as practically useful in the context of like a psychological, you know, consultation or something like that.
Although it's clearly useful when applying to future questions, certain analysis of history, of questions you couldn't identify, but you have got someone's chart, but you don't know the events surrounding a particular incident or what have you. Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. I mean, I think this precarious position that astrology is in is actually a fundamental factor in all of this. I mean, what I observe as a therapist is that this kind of astrology is mere entertainment shadow that is also has this unconscious, almost Christian fear of the devil's work, you know, magic, the occult kind of. So it's either mere entertainment or some darker shadow in the collective psyche pushes astrology to the fringes and creates a central insecurity, you know, in the profession in a way, because you could be a major figure in the world of astrology, and yet you're still a laughingstock in the larger cultural marketplace. And that's quite difficult for people when they've spent all their lives studying this really rather intensely complex subject on one level. And I think it's an issue in our larger community. And I will say this. I mean, I have a method and I teach a method, and this method can just read charts. But it reads them the most profoundly when you ally the symbolism of the chart to the consciousness of the individual. For me, the alchemical wedding, you know, the union, the yoga union of astrology for me at its profoundest is the union of the soul of the individual, the being of the client, the native, however you want to put it, and the symbolism, the highest realizations in their chart. And that does involve a method with me. It's not, you know, it's not just a completely subjective thing. And in the sense when I'm asking what a therapist would call their presenting issue, you know, why are you here today? I'm trying to create a lead into authenticity, the sense that they could come here and really put themselves into this and be committed to it and transform. I'm not necessarily accepting that the first thing they say is the deepest reason why they've come. Some people are that clear, mm-hmm. But some people are going to articulate that reason through speaking. Through speaking, they will reveal more about themselves, which I can ally then to these signatures in the chart and the you know, the method that I do have that was outlined in Healing the Soul, really quite a technical method in its own way. And then, so behind what the reason why they say they come, there may be deeper reasons. Fine. But also the reasons why they say they come also have to be respected. And they're also giving you a sense of where they're coming from as a consciousness. And this is where, in the debate you were having with Eric, I picked out, for me at least, I think a central point is the consciousness of the client. The consciousness, their concerns, their intentions, where they're really coming from. And even, if you like, from the point of evolutionary astrology, where they are in the evolutionary journey of their soul. Because it will make a massive difference to how the symbolism of the chart plays out or is interpreted. I do think consciousness is the great hidden factor in the astrology chart. And the difficult placement that a person has at one level of consciousness, let's say their level of consciousness is, I'm radically different and unusual, and I'm a freak, and I feel alienated, but I have to maintain my individuality at all costs, otherwise the world will take it from me, and I don't want to sell out to the man. And you interpret the stressful aspect from that point of view. You know, it's all through a certain lens in their being. That's how they experience themselves, both profoundly individual, but somehow also always prone to being a victim or swallowed up by other authorities or life, as if it's going to claim that back. Versus, say, interpreting the chart of like a lama, a Tibetan lama, is just clearly in a different space than most people. You know, the astrology, the Dalai Lama's chart is going to play out in a certain way that might actually be quite profoundly different from someone who had a very similar chart, who isn't, you know, coming from the place where the Dalai Lama is coming from.
Sure, and I mean, you know, even from a traditional standpoint, in the 2nd century, Ptolemy said that astrology is contextual, that you have to take into account the background of the client, like that somebody from, I mean, he used an example that was like regional, like somebody from like the Middle East with their cultural customs and background would have a different interpretation than somebody from Rome or what have you in the 2nd century with the Roman sort of cultural customs and values and backgrounds and their social status and their gender and so on and so forth. So it's like that's valid. And then – but this is actually a huge topic, and this could maybe be the main topic for a large part of the rest of the episode, which is this other thing that's come into play because I don't know. Like I've been trying to see if I could find this in – traditional text, but I think it is more of a modern idea, and it is one of the major contrasting differences when it comes to difficult placements is that modern astrologers oftentimes will say that the way in which a placement manifests has to do with a person's consciousness and their level of consciousness or level of spiritual evolution. And I really have some sort of like visceral reaction to that because it sets up this kind of hierarchy of like spiritual evolution, and there's an implication to it, which I think definitely came out in Eric's position in Eric's work, that those who are more spiritually evolved have less bad things, you know, quote unquote, subjectively negative things happen to them, but instead the more positive or constructive versions of the astrological placements or transits or what have you will tend to be more dominant in their life. And I think there's a huge assumption that's being made there that's not necessarily correct. I mean, sometimes people that are very, however you can even quantify that, let's say spiritually evolved or people like, you know, Tibetan monks or what have you, still have very terrible things happen to them in the practical physical plane.
God, yes. Look at the Dalai Lama having to flee Dharamsala through the Tibetan mountains and the danger of being caught and killed. And many young monks were caught and tortured and killed to absolutely horrific levels. I mean, I was talking to a Lama about it once, who's his own cousin had been forced at gunpoint, held to a Buddhist nun, to kill animals with a small knife and with his bare hands, breaking all his vows. Otherwise, a Buddhist nun would be hurt and then shot in front of him. You know, torture enacted on these peaceful, loving, focused, spiritual community of beings. It's very sad. Terrible things happen. I mean, look at Christ. you know, he got crucified, one of the most painful deaths. The Romans invented crucifixion because they were master sadists, and they knew how much it hurt to have your chest collapse into your own lungs through the pressure of being held up like that.
I mean, if Christ was more spiritually evolved, would he have had a more positive, like, you know, a more positive experience of whatever transit he was having when he was crucified? I mean,
that's an interesting question, because could you argue that it was the great, however, it would be personally a fairly bad experience, I think, the day you were crucified. I mean,
well, no,
I'm going to guess.
Finish what you're saying, because actually I would agree with that conclusion, that sometimes it is, unfortunately, and that's even a hard position to take, but I think a lot of traditional astrologers are going to end up coming to that position, and I don't know that that's going to be popular, but there are, you know, sometimes there are fixed or predetermined things that are not fun that do almost seem like they are an important part of the person's life or what they're here to do, and that's not
that
something
elevated him. Yes, in Steiner's terms, the mystery of Golgotha, the crucifixion event, was the shining, was the way he, or the larger him, the Christ rather than Jesus, maybe, or I don't want to split too much, but, you know, the essence of his spiritual mission shone out to the world. My true nature does not change when my body is tortured and killed. And that's a very profound spiritual truth in my view. And I would bow to the Christ on that level, personally, without being anything like a conventional Christian in most people's eyes.
Most conventional Christians don't practice astrology and discuss people's past lives and future and past incarnations most of the time.
Yeah. And, I mean,
unless
I
that,
I would,
that,
I,
that might be a denomination I'm not familiar with, like a
Clearly, actually, it turns out to be a really interesting example. Christ's crucifixion in personal terms is a terrible thing. You know, he was publicly vilified. He had a joke court, joke tribunal, like sadly is going on all around the world. You know, even as we speak, there's a mockery of a trial. He's vilified for things he didn't do. He's whipped and beaten, has to carry his own cross, and then is crucified upon it. Along, you know, the Romans crucified thousands and thousands of people. And it's become one of the greatest, even if you're not a Christian, let's assume you don't believe in the spiritual truth of that. It's still one of the most powerful myths, one of the most powerful impacts, just as an idea. The radicalism of early Christianity, which was like a revolutionary thing, has just taken hold and just shaped Western culture. Remarkable. So yeah, certain, in quotes, difficult things are the making of us. Certain terrible traumas, when people, those people who can become like the phoenix and rise from the ashes of their former self, they are stronger often. They are, their eyes have been opened to a new kind of love, the love that can take in the suffering of the world rather than run away from it or reject it.
Sure. And it sort of just brings us back to this question about a person's level of spiritual evolution as somehow being related to or having some relation to or dictating how they will experience natal chart placements or transits. And because I think where this comes in sometimes is in modern astrology, the way that I've observed it is sort of, I don't want to say an objective observer, but as stepping outside of it, as I sometimes see it as a sort of like fudge factor in order to account for the acknowledged, I think even traditional astrologers would acknowledge the sort of wide spectrum of different manifestations of a specific placement, that since we're talking about things in terms of archetypes, there's many different manifestations of a specific placement. And sometimes in order to sort of skirt that issue, I don't know if I should phrase it that negatively of skirt the issue, because that's not necessarily, but to a certain extent, that's what happening is what's happening is the issue is being skirted by saying that it's completely up to the person's consciousness, how this manifests, or it's completely up to their level of spiritual evolution of how this manifests. And I mean, there's something appealing about that from a practical consulting astrologer standpoint, because then you don't have to say, you don't have to say this is probably likely how you're going to experience that. You can leave it open so that you can say, well, it could be there be, you know, this constructive thing, or you could have this sort of nightmare scenario, and it's up to you to figure that out. But one of the ways that that might backfire that I fear, and actually I think Demetra George brings this up in her book, Astrology of the Authentic Self, which I highly recommend because she's trying to merge modern and traditional astrology and she's wrestling with some of these issues. But one of the things that she points up is that that approach, while it's meant to make things more empowering and more free will oriented by leaving that spectrum open, it can sometimes backfire by implicitly putting it on the client and saying, if this works out poorly, it's because you're not very spiritually evolved or there's something wrong with you inherently.
Exactly. Ken Wilber went through this experience with his wife Treya in the book Grace and Grit. You know, all their new age friends turning on her because she had cancer and because she wasn't getting better from it, and she went on to die from it.
Wow.
And it's judged on you, you know, because you didn't juice enough or you didn't, you know, get in touch with the deeper forgiveness that would have healed the body. Now, to me, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of karma and manifestation going on here. You see, your evolutionary state does dictate the level of your awareness. Yes, you do have almost complete autonomy about the kind of awareness that you have, the place that your consciousness is in, even when something good happens or when something terrible happens. But that does not mean that you control manifestation. Manifestation is an interlocking series of events. There is individual karma, collective karma, nation's karma, you know, the history of just some conflict that you're involved in. You know, a bomb goes off. It doesn't matter if you're a Tibetan Lama or whatever, if you're in the center of the blast. There are collective situations and complex factors around manifestation. If something terrible happens to you, if you're attacked on the street, or I believe it was an example in the previous discussion, say like raped or something, the idea that this is your fault is a complete misunderstanding of karma, and it projects onto karma the Western notions of sin. It really is a kind of unconscious Christian legacy being misapplied to Eastern philosophy. Mm-hmm. Karma, to me, action or the implied principle of karma, is all to do with memory. Universal memory and individual long-term memory. It is to do with the accumulated habits and patterns and emotional and psychological memory of lifetimes. So it is to do with certain areas of experience you've been drawn to. It is not the same as you did something terrible and therefore you're going to get something terrible back. That's like an Old Testament view of karma. It's like a judgmental God coming down to, you know, punish you for your sins. This isn't part of the psyche of India and, you know, the great Hindu and Buddhist nations that produced the concept of karma, really, and offered it to the spiritual traditions of the world. They didn't have that mentality about it. It's much more impersonal. You know, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna's conversation with Arjuna, it's a much more impersonal level of response. It's not about right or wrong or good or bad in a Christian judgmental sense. And even actually, we could say the unconscious Christian shadow, the legacy of Christianity, has an impact even on this discussion about difficult aspects. Mm. That our concern about good and bad is linked to sin and, you know, God and the devil and, you know, whether you're a good person or whether you've committed a mortal sin kind of thing. And so we've got this huge shadow over these issues in our collective unconscious that I think confuse the issue. It's inner goodness does not guarantee that everything will happen to you in your life is good. If you're good in a world surrounded by selfish murderers, you will get hurt. You know, if you are a good person who has sensitive values, who wants to help a hurt person on the street, and you grow up in some gangland territory where all your compadres want to get their first kill to show off to their buddies that they're right for the gang, then you're in trouble, aren't you? It's a collision of values. Inner goodness is one thing. How it manifests in the world is based on all sorts of other factors.
Okay. I think that's something I could get on board with in terms of framing ideas of consciousness being relevant and or even evolution of consciousness for that matter in that way. I guess I only get nervous about it when it becomes allied and sort of intermingled more with like the secret and the sort of law of attraction type thinking.
Yes.
Where your personal sort of consciousness or your will in some sense, the way you're directing your attention towards things, completely dictates the manifestation of things in your physical life. So that it becomes almost like a very egocentric type thing where you can control your own world and material circumstances if only you change your consciousness. And while there's something to that, I don't want to completely like remove the element of consciousness.
Yes.
And the element of personal volition and self-motivation and things like that in order for people to make constructive changes in their life. It's just harder when you were talking about things that are outside of a person's control, that especially things that have to do with hardship. Although Lisa, last night we were coming back, Lisa Scheim and I were coming back from a talk in Boulder where Rick Levine had given a talk. One of the things that she pointed out just in conversation is oftentimes, like modern astrologers, fate is only discussed within a negative context, that we only talk about like fated events, and they're all often argued against when we're talking about negative things. But oftentimes modern astrologers don't acknowledge or don't seem to realize, I guess, or take into their contextualization that sometimes you could have a completely predetermined event, theoretically, that's positive, like, you know, meeting a person that you would later get married to, or, you know, on the subway randomly that day or something like that. And that's another element of that that probably needs to be integrated into discussions like this at some point.
Well, so I say discussion number two, that we have fate and free will, could be a possibility, because that's a deep conversation. Just to say one thing about The Secret, by the way. I mean, The Secret just makes me laugh, particularly the film. I haven't read the book. Maybe it's better, but the film just made me laugh hysterically. I mean, the idea that that is the greatest spiritual secret ever told, or, you know, hidden for centuries and now revealed, just made me practically cry with laughter. And the, you see, what it does, it takes an idea that what you hold in mind and the things you focus on with your will and your mind and your imagination and your heart will tend to manifest more easily, which is true. Mm-hmm. And it tries to make this into this glorious, you know, revelation. You can make the world the way you want it. You can totally create your own reality. And it's just a question of asking God for how many millions he's going to give you next year. And, you know, if you're not a millionaire in 3 years' time, you've not been working hard enough. And that's where the fantasy of America, the fantasy of the new world, the fantasy of constant exploration and growth. You know, when we run out of Earth, we'll make it space through, you know, Star Trek or whatever. The final frontier, the expansion, the ever positive idea. It's just all to do with human unconscious fantasies. It's nothing to do with spiritual reality. You know, there's some of the greatest spiritual teachers of all time, the great Tibetan lamas, the Zen masters, they lived in simple huts or caves. You know, they paid attention to the changing of the seasons. When someone they loved died, they cried. When something funny happened, they laughed. You know, it's not about having some big house in California and twisting and manipulating reality to get your own selfish, egoic needs met. That's not the evolution of consciousness. That's actually spiritual materialism, which right. Chogyam Trungpa wrote, you know, a genius analysis of in a book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's just a ego fantasy placed onto a spiritual platform. So we have to watch that kind of thing constantly, especially the way that a kind of pseudo-spirituality is allied with astrology to try and make everybody feel better. And I agree totally with this idea of at least fated events. Whether I'm not, you know, I'd question that fate and predestination are the same thing. I think things can be intensely fated without being predestined, if that makes sense. And it's something I'll have to think about myself, how to explain what I mean by that. But
yeah, I look forward to that. That would be a great, that should definitely be our next discussion. And maybe in order to bring this around full circle to our topic, one of the things I would like to say is just sort of conceding the point that it's not necessarily a good idea to use terms like benefic and malefic in their most extreme sense in the context of a consultation. And that's something I'm wrestling with as somebody who is reviving a lot of these ancient techniques that do tend to be a bit more deterministic and prediction oriented, but also precise about being able to say specific things about where a person will encounter some of the most challenging or difficult parts of their life, like what area of their life that they'll struggle with the most and have some of the greatest hardships versus yes. some parts of the life that perhaps will tend to go the smoothest for them and where the least amount of effort will be needed in order for positive or constructive things to happen. And the way to phrase some of those things in the context of consultation is something that I'm still working out and struggling with and trying to come to terms with. And I do, at least at this point, agree with the modern position that even my middle ground between those two is that we can use these terms in discussions amongst astrologers. And I don't think it should be like the 1980s where, I guess like Noel Till got Llewellyn to remove, and they made it a standard policy so that the terms benefic and malefic could not be used in any astrology books or any.
I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, he actually told me that. I learned that not too long ago, and had a spirited discussion with him at the ESAR conference in September, where he told me that he'd been trying for years to get rid of those terms. And I told him, well, that I was bringing them back.
that went down well.
Yeah, he did not appreciate that. So, but my point that I will concede, though, and that I would concede to Noel Till and to you and other modern astrologers, is that I think that we can use these terms and they still have some valid conceptual or theoretical role to play in astrology. But in the context of a consultation, I think it is more appropriate and useful and productive probably to use, I don't want to say synonyms, but to use or euphemisms in some way, because that almost sounds too negative, but it is a type of euphemism to say challenging or to say, you know, difficult or difficulties or what have you. And maybe you would classify those as still being too extreme, but I think maybe alternates like that are more
exercising caution, isn't it? Out of respect for the unknown subjective experience of the person before you and how they might internalize it and go away with it, and to pay attention to the legacy of the reading, that it's not just the X amount of time you spend with them, the hour, the 90 minutes, whatever, that it's about the legacy of the reading, what they're left with as they go away. And I'll say two things here. One, I'm really excited and I want to publicly nudge you in the direction of your forthcoming book eventually, and to read more about certain, you know, traditional and ancient techniques myself, and make informed decisions about them because of the good scholarly work of other colleagues. And to, you know, at the risk of sounding self-promoting, gone to great lengths with this therapeutic astrology book to put certain points across. And I'm developing a Counseling Skills for Astrologers tuition program, series of MP3 downloads and accompanying essays that will be released, you know, alongside the book, so that I can express to people certain points about this legacy of the reading and what people go away with. And this will be non-denominational, if you like. You know, it's not about evolutionary astrology or Marx's method, or you have to follow Marx's method to follow the Counseling Skills for Astrologers program. No, I've created a program for just any practicing astrologer who just wants to think about client dynamics. And I've summarized some of the best information in 20th century psychology and translated it into how it could be directly useful for an astrologer in a reading. And that's it. No denomination. No, you have to be looking at outer planets. You have to follow my method of Pluto, Uranus, and the nodes. No, none of that. Just, you know, what's going on when you sit down for a consultation with someone, and how has the work of Carl Rogers helped or hindered that? What's Gestalt got to offer to that? What were Freud and Jung thinking about these things? How can you think about these things? How might you deal with it if some active trauma comes up that's still going on in the client's life? It's not theoretical. It's actually happening to them still in the present. How will you handle that? How will you handle, you know, if a client starts telling you how this has meant so much to them and they're crying and they can't leave the room and you've gone over time and you don't know what else to say to them? Or a client that freaks out at you and just gets angry because you've said they've got a difficult Mars and you've made some guy feel emasculated. So this program will be exploring, having trained as a therapist, having been a practicing therapist for 13, 14 years, having had years of supervision as a therapist, and it's this missing component. When you become an astrologer, no one supervises you. Or maybe for a brief time, you carry on an email exchange with the person who taught you or the little group that supported you. But when I started work as a therapist, all my early client work was examined in depth by a group and by a very experienced individual therapist who've been doing it for decades. And this is the missing component for me in the world of astrology. And I'm offering this program, and really, you know, the illumination that's come from being a therapist for years to try and help the profession in a larger way than just my kind of astrology or even just modern astrology, never mind just evolutionary astrology. And just say that anyone who's just serious about working with people and maybe really offering them something in their life, some real guidance, that there are certain principles and certain key ideas that they might want to contemplate before doing that, so that they're ready for it. So they're not put off by, because it can be overwhelming. And I've worked with people, really talented astrologers, who gave up. who had their own little business going from telephone or Skype in their little office somewhere, and for a variety of reasons couldn't handle it. You know, one-off readings, never having any feedback about how it worked out for the client, feeling therefore too alone in the work. And for others, it was just the lack of discussion then about, you know, the way they'd interpreted the chart. Was that the right way? And these are very difficult questions for people starting out. And a lot of people never work with clients because of these fears and concerns. And I'm trying to address these in a much more systematic and a much more honest and rigorous way.
Yeah, and I think that's very needed. And I'm definitely looking forward to your book coming out in May, especially because one of the things that's interesting to me that I've noticed is that there's now, because the revival of traditional astrology is 10 or 20 years old now, I'm starting to see students come in and people starting to get into practice now at this point, that they're gone past the point of students. They're actually seeing clients, but they're people that came in through traditional astrology and like picked up William Lilly's 17th century textbook on astrology, and that was their introduction to astrology, and that they've stayed more or less in that area. And one of the things I'm somewhat concerned about is that in bypassing modern astrology, some traditional astrologers now are missing out on the parts of modern astrology that were very useful in terms of those skills of client of consultation skills and consulting and therapeutic rules and sort of pointers that are very crucial when you do have discussions with people. And those are things that I had the benefit of getting because I came in through modern astrology and then went into traditional. But if you just came in through traditional, you might not get that right away because you can't, Lilly doesn't tell you what to do if a client, you know, breaks down into tears at the end of your consultation with them. He just tells you how to predict, you know, whether they will win the lottery or get married or what have you. So yeah, I think that's very valid. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm hoping that's one of the next things that traditional astrologers need to do is more clearly define some of the rules of what is appropriate or what is not appropriate in the context of a consultation or consultation setting. And I think looking at pointers or going through guides like your book could be very useful in that context. So, all right. Well, I think that brings us about to the end of our hour. So thanks for joining me. I look forward to talking to you again next time. And yeah, maybe fate and free will would be a good discussion topic for a future episode.
Well, we could just start with that small dilemma, couldn't we? And see where we go with it.
Yeah, I'm sure we could talk for quite a while about that.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. And all right. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, please rate us, give us a nice rating on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast through the email subscription list on the sidebar, and check out Mark's website, which is plutoschool.com. All right, well, we'll see you next time.